We have an amazing guest here with us, Dr. Ismaheen Alwafi. She's the Director General for International Center for Biosaline Agriculture. She's using science to combat poverty, and she's also an award-winning scientist. She's rated in the top 100 most powerful women in the GCC, and she's a big inspiration to many, many people. But let's hear a little bit more about her background.
Dr. Ismaheen Alwafi is the Director General of the ICBA. ICBA stands for International Center for Biosaline Agriculture and is a not-for-profit research facility aiming to improve the well-being of poor farmers in marginal environments. One example, the ICBA delivers agricultural and water scarcity solutions to farmers in dry environments like the UAE. The ICBA was set up in 1999 through the Islamic Development Bank, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries Fund, the Arab Fund for Economic and Social Development, and the government of the UAE. Before becoming the Director General of the ICBA in 2012, Dr. Ismaheen was leading the Research and Partnerships Division at the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. Ismaheen holds a PhD in genetics from Cordoba University in Spain. She has a true passion for science. She believes that in order to make farming efficient and alleviate discrimination and poverty, science has to be the basis of one's decisions and development plans. Over her 15 years' experience in agricultural research, Dr. Ismaheen was successful in developing strategic partnerships with governments, universities, and private organizations in the national and international scientific research arena. Muslim Science ranked Dr. Ismaheen among the 20 most influential women in science in the Islamic world. In 2014, the CEO Middle East magazine listed Dr. Ismaheen among the world's 100 most powerful Arab women in the science category. And Dr. Ismaheen Alwafi was recently awarded the National Reward Medal by His Majesty Mohammed VI, the King of Morocco.
Well, welcome, Dr. Ismaheen. Welcome so much to Eye on Careers.
Thank you, Shane.
I don't think I've had an award-winning scientist on the show before. We've had pretty much everything else, so that's pretty exciting. I don't know, how do you become a scientist? It seems like one of those kind of things you just see on movies, right? You know,
that's true. Like, so I'm glad I'm the first one. I'm glad it's the woman is the first scientist to be on the program.
We have lots. Last week we had the first Saudi woman to climb Mount Everest, and then we had Amberine Moussa, who is a woman from the small little island of Mauritius, who went on to work, you know, get herself a university education, got a job in GE, worked for MasterCard, worked for Bain & Company, and then quit all the corporate life and started her own company called SouqAlMal.com, the first financial comparison website in the Middle East. So we had all women the last show, and now we love featuring women. So what can we do? But thanks again for coming. So how does it start out? I mean, like when you were a kid, you know, did you say, "Hey, I'm going to be a scientist," or were you just like really into, you know, into sciences and maths and stuff? Or, you know, tell us about that journey.
So I think as I was going through my schooling, I was always very much curious to get to know science. Like it started with mathematics for everybody, and they loved mathematics, and I was pretty good at it. And as soon as I discovered biology, it was great. It was like I came to understand so many things biological, that I lost almost all interest for mathematics, and I moved to biology and physics. So I think I have that curiosity in me, and I think it's almost everybody has it. Everybody really, it's looking to learn and it's looking to improve. But for me, biology was really the biggest and the most interesting things I ever came across. Like I loved history, but I never really get into it. Whereas with biology, the more I know about it, the more I know about cells, the more I understand the mechanisms, the pathways, how the things are done, the more I became interested in it. So I think it was a little bit of each time it's like a big light coming through my life, and then I keep going and going and going. So I knew I had to make it in science, different disciplines in science. And I think once I went to the university, I lost a little bit interest because there was no much new things that I'm learning. till I came across genetics. And in genetics, it's heredity. You understand how the genes move from generation to generation. You understand the history and the linkages between different species. And that's also, it was for my master degree. I got another wow moment when I find out about genetics, and I got very much in depth in genetics. So I think I was made to become a scientist.
So it wasn't really this grand vision of becoming this, you know, impactful scientist, but more listening to your inner voice, playing to your strengths, and doing what you do best, and just following that natural path.
Absolutely. And I think it's very important for people when they are going through their schooling system to just understand what gets into them. So instead of just wanting to be a lawyer because a lawyer can make a lot of money, or a doctor because of such and such, what you have to look for is what really gets you motivated, what gets you so engaged that you don't care about how many hours you're going to spend studying. So if you can find that discipline that really motivates you, that's really get into you, that's what you have to follow. So you follow your heart, basically.
Yeah, I always think that, you know, if you really want to be successful in what you do, you need a superhuman performance. And, you know, that's kind of the subtext of what you're talking is find something that's going to ignite you beyond a normal level of energy, a normal level of commitment, a normal level of focus, that, you know, you get to that superhuman level where you can study for, you know, 5 million hours that you probably have done, or whatever it takes to become as smart as you are. You need that superhuman element. So what is it that's going to allow you to be superhuman? Is one of the things that I always ask people, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's a different story for many people, but let's focus on what makes you happy in some ways. What music makes you happy, that's what define which music you're going to listen. So when you are studying or you're looking for your career path, think about it too. What makes you really happy?
But the road to the top, isn't it laden with painful, dark moments where sometimes you just want to throw yourself off a bridge?
Absolutely. That's always the case. Yeah. So you have to just maneuver and keep positive and try again and again and take the rat path. Whenever you came to a crossroad, you have to be somehow a little bit lucky, but also very, very intelligent and knowing yourself very well. So you know if you take it this way, that might happen, but would that make you what you are, or you better go that way where you have better rate of success and better satisfaction rate as well.
I'm glad you mentioned it though, because so many people, they hear this, hey, follow what I love, do what I'm passionate about, do what I like, and then, you know, the initial early stages could suck really bad, and then they feel, hey, this isn't the right path, and then they quit. But you need to be able to push through those dark moments. You know, I think isn't that the difference between a champion and a regular person, is that when the pain comes, when the darkness comes, when all hope is lost, the champion pushes on, but the average person throws in the towel.
Absolutely. Persistence is very, very important.
Dubai I-103.8. Stay one step ahead.
We are here with one of the most celebrated Arabic scientists in the world, Dr. Ismaheen Al-Wafi. She's the Director General of the International Center for Biosaline Agriculture. Doctor, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Thank you.
And so here we have a few of the audience has been SMSing their answers as to whether they think it's hard work or it's destiny. So one person says, you know, luck is plays a role in destiny. So success does require luck. But if you're not lucky, you're going to need a lot of hard work. That's from Walid al-Bashir. So it looks like he's playing both sides of the coin there to keep a safe bet. So he may be a risk manager. I'm not sure. He's hedging his position. The next guy, Mansour, here says it's the combination of good fortune and hard work which brings success. Again, you know, I think they're playing both sides of the coin here. Strategic players. Here we have Lucille, who says hard work and passion is what you do is the only sure way to get success. A bit of luck might help you, but only true hard work will get you there. What do you think is really more important, luck or hard work? What would you rather be, lucky or have a Spartan-like work ethic?
Absolutely hard work. I don't think luck has anything to do with it. Otherwise, I mean, you could take an example of a person that's born wealthy, but they're not hard worker. They could lose it in any time. So right. For me, it's like no-brainer. It's only hard work that can take you there.
It's the and now someone's adding a new one, is that it's love that brings success. But I don't know if that could be. I think in Reno's case, I mean, he was singing love songs while he was on the air with us. So maybe it is love. So tell us a little bit about the research and the work you're doing. So you're bringing fresh water to farmers in marginal environments.
Yes. So the center, it's now called ICBA Agriculture for Tomorrow. And the center mission, it's really to help farmers, poor farmers in marginal environments, to have a viable agriculture system. So what we are trying to do is actually get agriculture and get food production or feed or fuel production in areas that people 100 years ago never paid attention to. That's what we call marginal environments. So it's a lot of innovation. Technologies, new technologies that we are looking for. It's new crops that we are looking for that could have a production in bare land, like the desert, for example.
Right. Now, this work will go to, you know, populations, I guess, that are having trouble sustaining themselves. Or is it going to go to multinational cash crops? So, you know, at the end of the day, once they get their hands on the technology, we're right back to square one.
We hope that really we are targeting the poorest of the poor, because the Green Revolution, when it happened in the 60s, it was wonderful, but it was always targeting only the arable land. And in the arable land, you got the wealthy people. And as you said, the multinational just jumped on it. And then we got this huge seed companies, huge fertilizer companies, input companies that became so big and so international that they really eat up the whole market. So what we are hoping for is that by targeting the poorest of the poor with technologies that's going to be affordable for them, that we're going to make a difference and we can alleviate about 800 million poor people from those region.
Wow, that's amazing. I heard that, and I don't know if this, you probably, you know, obviously you know more about this than I do, but what I heard was that 50%, up to 50% of the food today is thrown out. You know, like that we actually throw away 50% of our food, you know, that we produce. So in fact, you know, the question is, you know, is it really that we don't have the technology to help these 800 million people, or is it that we really just don't care?
I think there is a reality that there is the problem lays in the distribution. So we do have enough production for the world, but it's badly distributed. It's like weather. You got so much rain in Canada and none of it here. So
Vancouver, Canada gets more rain than the Amazon basin does. And I don't know how you knew that, because most people, but that's an actual fact.
That's true. So the distribution is definitely right. So actually the number I know myself is about 30% is lost from farm to fork. So you got a lot of lost in the value chain and from the whole chain. But the problem also is that we are a growing population. We're going to be 9 billion by 2050. And for those 9 billion, we don't have enough production, because unfortunately, we produce so much in those arable land that they are becoming bare land as well. So we intensify the agriculture in so many places that we damage the environment and we damage the land, we damage the inputs and so on and so forth. So for the future, even if we fix the problem of distribution, we still have not enough food for everybody.
So what's the vision? I mean, where is this going? Is it one day that, Saudi Arabia is going to look like the Congo? Where does this technology actually lead us? And what does the future of this technology look like?
I think what we are looking for, it's, for example, a better use of the solar energy, a better use of the salty water. So we have about only 1%. We have only about 1%. It's fresh water. The rest of it, it's all saline water. So if we can find a way to use saline water as is from the sea to produce a crop, that's going to solve a huge problem. And that's what we are looking for. It's much more a better use of the input that we have without changing them. For example, we are working on a biofuel that's called Saliconia with mustard, as a matter of fact. It's that we are
with
using
Masdar
with Masdar, yeah, from Abu Dhabi.
Oh, Masdar.
Yes. Masdar, yeah.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry.
So, and what we are using, it actually, it's the seawater to produce it on land. So it's using the different things that people we haven't thought about, but to make it happen, you are looking at different crops. So we will never have wheat in the sandy soil of UAE. We'd never produce maize, for example, but maybe we can produce quinoa. And as a matter of fact, the quinoa production in the UAE, in Academic City next door to here, it's amazing. It's 5 times more than the production in Peru, for example. So it's looking at the right crop in the right place. So it's the whole package, but you start from the crop. You stop focusing on the major crops that we have in one a days. And if you want a striking number, 60% of the protein that people are taking are from 3 crops, wheat, maize, and rice. There is too much focus on few crops, whereas on the earth, a human being have used about 7,000 species. So we got about 7,000 species that are eatable, that we can use, and we are focusing on 60% of our protein intake. So
why is that?
I think it's globalization. It's becoming the same. Wherever you go, you eat the same food. Wherever you go, it's the same airport, it's the same everything. So it's the multinational system that is taking it to every little corner of the world and pushing their product through. And that's why there's too much focus on few crops. And what we are trying to promote ourselves as a center, ICBA, it's diversification. Is that you have to diversify because not every region has to produce the same thing. Maybe if you keep to your native species or maybe if you keep to certain species, you are better off. And second thing is that with climate change, the conditions are different. So you need to diversify. A farmer normally diversifies. If you talk to any farmer from Latin America, Africa, wherever you go, there are people, they are risk takers, but they are also to understand that the weather, it's never the same every year. So you will find a farmer who will make a little bit of this produce and a little bit of that one. They diversify to make sure that they have a minimum of a production. But what we are pushing the farmers to do, it's monoculture. Like if you go to Canada, we give example of the prairies, it's all the same crop in the prairies. So it's this monoculture that has been pushed by multinational that is changing the world. It's changing the market, it's changing the habits, and what we are trying to do is really bring new crops on the market.
Right, right. But it looks nice when you have one crop because you just have these golden fields for miles. It's quite, aesthetically it's nice.
But it's not the best for the market.
It's not good. It's not good for our future. So I think but that's one of the funny things that they had this book, the world is flat, that, you know, globalization is going to make us, you know, pretty much all the same. And then you saw right away in the financial crisis from a risk perspective, the impact that has. That right now that, a black swan event can just sweep right across the globe in hours, almost, you know, maybe I'm being exaggerated, but within a few weeks, you really can have a contagion that goes from east to west, north to south. And so you're saying this is a major risk from the scientific community is saying that, this is a major issue from an agricultural perspective as well.
Absolutely. And for humankind, too, it's so beautiful that we are different. We have different languages. We have different cultures. So we don't want to lose that diversity. So the diversity has been created. We are damaging it. And There is a lot of centers in the world. We are not the only one, but we are trying to retrieve a little bit the species that used to be in the modern environments and try to promote them and try to find the right package to make them produced at economical level and also give them access to the market.
So do you think with globalization, I mean, you have these big agricultural conglomerates that really own the shelf space, you know, at the retail front, who really kind of have a commanding presence across the value chain. Do you really think that, you know, these fringe agricultural projects will ever be able to find their way into mainstream?
They will need help. I mean, it's not easy to do it. Like, if we are thinking about Africa, in Africa there is a huge problem of infrastructure. You can produce the thing, but you can't have access to the market. And to get the access to the market, you need help from the government, you get help from the development, the international development banks, for example, and you need also a little bit of a change in the culture. Instead of looking from a rice coming from India, for example, you have to think local and maybe buy the rice from the next door, or maybe not buy the teff. If you are in Ethiopia, you buy different grains. So it's a little bit of a community thinking that we need, and a little bit of, a little bit of help to get that produced to the market. So if you can do it local, that will be the best, absolutely. But if you can't and you want to produce at a larger scale, you have to have that help to get access to the market. And the history of quinoa, of anchovies, or few species that showed up lately, it's a very great example. And the big rush for them wasn't because they were exotic. It's much more because they were high protein content. Like for quinoa, it's about 19%. So people were after eating healthy grains instead of eating wheat, which is about 9% or 8% protein. So sometimes it's just showing what's very good in that produce or what could be the benefit for the person that could attract the interest from the market and from the consumers.
Dubai Eye 103.8, keeping you up to date with what matters in the UAE. Stay one step ahead.
Right now, we are talking to Dr. Ismahane Alwafi, who is the Director General of the International Center for Biosaline Agriculture. Dr. Ismahane, welcome back to Eye on Careers.
Hi, hello.
We have a few more people who are taking a stab at this. Here's by someone anonymous. They didn't leave their name. It says, hard work teaches you a lot in life. Luck is useless if you do not know what to do when you get luck. And Nitin says, if you work hard and are sincere, luck will automatically come your way. And another person says, keep on working hard and one day luck will come to you. I like how a lot of people are taking both sides of the fence here. You know, they're like they're I guess they're tied together, right? Because I think they say the harder you work, the luckier you get, right? Which is I think what our listeners are saying. Do you believe that? Are you no?
I don't think so.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So. You know, I think, you know, like you said, you have to love what you do, but you did admit at the beginning of the show that the road to the top has some very dark moments, some very deep crevices, some moments where you feel like giving up or you feel like quitting. Mm-hmm. When you look back on your career, what have been some of the most challenging moments or the darkest moments that you've had to face?
I think it's always much more, I would call it disappointment myself. And the disappointment mostly in people, that's the difficult one. So even as a manager, I find people management is the hardest part. I find financial management is okay, action management is okay. But when it comes to the people, that's the difficult one. Because I'm a kind of emotional person, so I'm an emotional boss in somehow, and that makes me what I am. But I trust people, and when I trust people, it's 100% trust. So I'm expecting certain level of work, performance, standard, values and ethics. So when a people disappoint me, it gets into me really. It's really very tough. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges I find as if I look back in my career. The second big challenge, it's really the balance between between work and family. As a woman, and I think maybe men, they don't have that problem, but as a woman, you got your biology and your biological clock working out, and in the same time, you are very passionate about your career, and in many times, you have to choose between one or the other. It's very difficult to combine them and have and find the right balance and equilibrium between career and life, family life. So I think that's the two main challenges that I came across several times throughout my career.
Well, I think it's a fallacy. And again, you know, I'm one of the believers that most of the information you're given in life is false. You know, and when they start to talk about being successful, you know, and then they say, well, you know, live a balanced life. Well, you know, people who are at the pinnacle of their game don't have balance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's
yeah,
just that simple. You have to make sacrifices.
Yeah, and it has to be a balance in your perspective. It might not be the balance that you would agree with, but for every person, you find a balance again that makes you what you are, and that work out well for you. So it's not a balance in a way that it's exactly the same for everybody, but it's the balance for your own family, for your own person, that you feel comfortable with, and that you can work out the things successfully for you and your family.
Like I mentioned, this Sunday, January 18th at 7 p.m. at the Canadian University of Dubai, we have Amberine Moussa, who is a leading female .com entrepreneur here in Dubai. I think she's one of the only female .com entrepreneurs. I think there's a few out there. But, you know, she felt it extra tough as a woman. Because she's coming from a very traditional family, and you know, wasn't really necessarily generally her society has, that you know, she's this alpha female that's making things happen and you know, getting mm-hmm. business done. Not really what the typical Mauritian woman does. And she's going to talk about that and how you overcome that on January 18th at 7 p.m., which is free. So if you guys want to come down there and check that, it's free. But for you, Dr. Ismahane, I wanted to ask you, you know, is being a woman, is it tougher? Did you ever feel that pressure, you know, or is a gender, you know, it's non-issue?
See, for me, I think my femininity, it's part of me. So I never try to be rough, tough, just to be tough. And as a matter of fact, I always find it really sorry that the women, when they come to leadership role, they became like men and they behave like men. And I'm completely against it. So leadership, it's mostly about motivating people. It's about engaging people. It's giving them a reason to follow you, giving them a reason to trust you and to believe that if they follow you, they're going to get somewhere to their dreams. So to do that, you don't need to be tough. You don't need to be like a man. You can do it your own way. You can do it whatever makes you. It's based on your character and what's your attitude. You can use exactly your attitude as well, as far as you are motivating those people. So I'm against it. I see it in some of my colleagues and my bosses, and I always try to remind them that, hey, I mean, if I want to make these people work better, I don't need to be tough with them. Maybe I need to understand them. Maybe I need to talk to them the same language that they can understand, and maybe I should pay attention to their private life to make sure that they perform well. So there is always a reason for underperformance. It could be that they don't have the capacity, and that's an easy one to fix because they are in the wrong place. They shouldn't be in that position. But it could be also that they don't have the conducive environment to perform well, and that's where I am focusing a lot myself. I really try to give a conducive environment for the employees in ICBA to perform well, especially scientists. I used to be a scientist myself. I know how peculiar they are, and I believe that you need a good balance of supervision and freedom to get really the scientists to produce what they produce, which is new technologies, innovation, publications.
Right. I think when you look at life in general, you know, you have a sun, it creates a light beam, that light beam comes to Earth, it hits a plant leaf, through photosynthesis, that light beam is then converted into energy, and you know the energy chain there goes forward. So the basis of life is actually energy itself. So and you know what you're talking about is energizing people to perform. And you know you either, I asked one CEO, you know, is it a job of leaders to motivate people? And he said, your job is not to demotivate people, because people come to work,
that's
they want to work.
Mm-hmm. That's a great way, yeah, to express it. Perfect.
So I guess you felt like that in your early career, that some of your boss's early career demotivated. So you came with a bunch of ambition and energy, and then that first Monday morning or Sunday morning meeting killed everything.
Absolutely. And it's because maybe in the business as a whole, it's the majority are men. And there is a certain trends in those leaders. So most of the women, when they make it up, they think that they have to become a photocopy of that image that we have of leaders. But I think the things are changing, because we have more and more women coming up, and hopefully the theories of leadership are also changing with having more women at different higher positions.
You know, when you look at, you know, especially in Dubai, what the infrastructure is like, is it's very conducive for men, women. I mean, I think Dubai is one place where it doesn't matter if you're black, white, Chinese, man, woman, you know, purple, green. You know, this is a city of opportunity. So some of the women that I talk to feel that, you know, the biggest challenge is their social pressures, that there are certain responsibilities and very vital roles that females play in a family environment. And as you said, that balance becomes tricky to maintain. You know, what is that a real issue in the GCC, or is that now for the next generation coming up? Is that an actual issue, or where does that stand?
I think it's an issue worldwide. So if I compare my time in Morocco versus Canada versus here, so I think that in some environments it's more conducive than others. I could say in Canada, it's very conducive for women to really climb up and have a leadership role or have a responsibility position. The same thing here. I agree with you. It's quite conducive. However, I think what the government is failing to do in many places, it's really to provide that understanding to the women, to provide them with different packages than men, because most of the time they need more time for a baby. I just had a baby like 45 days ago, and I could see the difference by being here versus when I had my first baby in Canada. So sometimes it laws and regulation that could build, you can build in the laws and the regulation more understanding of the woman condition, because the woman go through pregnancy, the woman go through giving birth and taking care of the kids. So how could you make sure that although the woman goes through that period, she has as many chances as the men that never leave the workforce? And as a matter of fact, if I look at science, for example, what we find out in most countries is that, yes, women are going to the university, they are doing better than men in general, they could have high degrees, they go to the workforce, and then they disappear. And this disappearance, there is different reason for it, but one of them is really having a family. So most of the women, they would go away and they come back and they are not as performing as men, or they don't have, not about the performance, sorry. It's much more about the years of experience, because the men have a steady grow up in the workplace, whereas the woman, she leaves and come back. So in my mind, Canada is doing great, sincerely. Canada, in their policies, they have taken in consideration that component, and they are trying to make a system that will allow women to come back to the workplace, find the same position, for example. They count their years off as years of experience, for example. So there are different little things that could help the woman come back to the workplace and have the same, chances as the men that they started their careers with. So whereas I don't see it here, for example, I don't see it in Morocco, I don't see it in many countries.
Dubai Eye 103.8, award-winning news, business, sport, and lifestyle coverage. Stay one step ahead.
Dr. Ismahain, tell us, you know, what's your message out there to, you know, the young women of the Arab world who have dreams, who have aspirations. They may be, you know, feeling a bunch of different challenges as they kind of try to grasp at the heights that you have reached, or sit back and dream of reaching the pinnacles of success that you have. What's your advice to them?
I think my first advice would be try and try and try. So it's again going back to the hard work. Being a hard worker, trying again. If you have a dream, then the dream would never fade away. So if you want to reach it, you have to try one way and second way and different times, different ways as well. I remember when I was at the university in Morocco, I wanted really to continue my studies and do postgraduate studies. And I was looking for fellowships throughout the world, wherever they are. I looked at New Zealand at some time, which is far away from a Moroccan perspective. So, and I remember I applied for something in Belgium. And I applied for it to the consulate, and the ladies told me, "Oh, we never had a student applying for it. Normally, it's only for employees." I said, "Who said so? If you look at the form, it doesn't say that it has to be only for employees." And she was stuck. She said, "Like, I have been in this job for 10 years. I never got an application for a student." I said, "Is it up to you to say yay or nay?" She said, no, I'm just sending my recommendation." I said, "Okay, just send it, and you could say whatever you want. You could put your recommendation." And I was walking out, and she said, "You know what your chances are, Mrs. Elouafi?" I said, "Yeah. How much?" She said, 2%. I said, "That's fine. Send it to Belgium. Send it to Brussels." And guess what? A week later, she called me, and she said, "I won the fellowship to Brussels, and I'm going there." So when I look back to it, somebody telling you that you have only 2% to win that fellowship, I would have just maybe gave up. But I didn't give up. And that's really the message. Never give up. If you have a dream, you have to follow your dream. If you want to be a scientist, which is a great profession, please try hard to get there. And by trying hard, it means hardworking and looking for opportunities. And that's where I agree with many of the SMS that came across. So being smart, it's really taking the opportunity up. Never let it go. So you have to be really, you have to know what you want. And once you know what you want, you don't let it go. You just follow it. And make it happen.
Yeah. I think one of the problems, you know, is people ask advice of people around them and say, hypothetically, if I wanted to be an award-winning scientist, chances are my friends are not award-winning scientists because I'm not one yet, right? You know, once you become, I'm sure you have lots of award-winning scientist friends, but before you became a scientist, you simply don't. So you're asking advice from people who don't know what it takes to be a scientist, don't know anything about being a scientist, and you're asking them advice, and they're giving you advice. You know, you should only take advice from them if you want what they have, right? And so this lady, for example, saying you only have 2%, you know, if you wanted to be an administrator in what she's doing, and there's nothing wrong with being an administrator, it's a great job, and they play a mm-hmm. very vital role, but, you know, you should only take advice from her if you want what she has, right? And yeah. so often we end up taking steers or letting people course correct our path rather than listen to our own inner voice. And that's one of the defining features, isn't it? Where you has something about your personality. Some people say you have resolve. Maybe it could be you're stubborn. I don't know which one it is. But
depends on the situation, right?
You know that you listen to that inner voice, and you don't. You're not flexible, right? You're rigid on your principles.
Absolutely. And when you find your inner voice, follow that inner voice. And I think that's what. Get people, they got distracted sometimes. They got distracted with so many things that we are learning. It's like one time I attended a presentation by a very famous writer from Egypt. Oh, gosh, I can't recall her name. But what she said when she started the conference, she said, "I'm going to undo what education did to you." So basically, in our education, we are putting people in squares. We are limiting people. And what we need to do is find those inner voice that you have in you, because the inner voice has nothing to do with what you learn from the society or what you learn in the school. It's much more what's it's you. So once you find it, follow it. And I think maybe that you can call it stubbornness sometimes, and maybe that's what I'm telling my daughter all the time. You're so stubborn, because she's listening to her inner voice.
Yeah.
But try to find what's in you, what you can give to this world, what you can contribute, because if you do it, your contribution is going to be worthwhile. Whereas if you follow somebody else's wishes, it won't make a big difference in the world.
And just to touch on this as we kind of play with the word stubborn, you know, a lot of the traits that make you successful can also make you derail.
Absolutely.
One of my mentors said, the brighter the light, the darker the shadow. So if you're out there and you've been knocked down and things just aren't working out, you may be just one step away from a huge success, and just don't give up.
Absolutely, I fully agree.
Well, Dr. Ismahane Alwafi, thank you so much for coming out tonight and sharing your story with us.
Thank you very much, Shane. It was a pleasure.